saying that, look, be very, very conscious of the nights. Here as well, the way that Allah describes the way this woman approaches Nabi Musa in the most respectful, modest, right, shy way. And she says to Nabi Musa that my father wishes to invite you and to give you ajr and reward for what you've done. Now some say that one came, some say that two came. Needless to say, he accepts the invitation. This is a man who has eaten in days. He's surviving off of leaves and plants of a tree. He gets an invite for dinner now. Can you imagine for a moment what's going on inside of his heart? 8 days of extremely difficult travel. Finds his way to this city south of Sham, away from Fir'aun's control. His jurisdiction is a better word, his control. And now he gets an invite for dinner. What looks like to be a very pious family. They begin to walk towards the house. And this is really where I want us to understand some akhlaqi. But it's a very famous point that I know a lot of my elders have probably heard. I don't know how many of my youth have heard this. But now Nabi Musa has no idea where he's going. So now they begin to walk towards the father's house. Okay? Now, an akhlaqi point, mahram and non-mahram interaction. Let's be very careful, let's understand. Musa's a man of God. Musa's a man of ethics and values and morals, right? A man of akhlaq. A man of dignity. And obviously he respects women because his first eyes were not on the water at the well. His first eyes laid on these two women who are waiting and waiting and waiting, and not one single man could even stop to see anything beyond what he was going through. Oblivious to the needs of anybody else. But especially as women, right? Even at that moment, the fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala now includes this in the Quran points to the fact that Allah is teaching us men a lesson to respect women. Not just your woman, respect all women. At that moment, can you imagine, this man is dying of thirst. I would jump inside the well. But he was worried about those women. So now they move towards the father's house. But then Nabi Musa does something very special. He says, naturally, the person who knows where they're going is the one to be followed. Right? If they're walking towards this woman's house, she would follow, she would lead, he would follow. Okay? But that's not a proper thing to do with a woman. Especially a woman who's non-mahram to you. So Musa now, in his akhlaq, in his humility, in his humbleness, he says, I will walk in front of you, you lead me from the back. Why? Two reasons possibly, given in tafsir and also in Aqa Jazairi's book, Qissahai Anbiya. Number one is that he understood that out of respect for a woman, look, if a woman is walking, even today, a woman is walking and right behind her is a man, she's bound to feel uncomfortable. She's bound to feel uncomfortable. Especially if it's just a strange man that you just met. Doesn't matter if he did something big for her, filled her bucket of water, got her sheep water. Doesn't matter. She will still feel uncomfortable. Musa is fully aware of that uncomfortable nature of the woman. Number one. Number two, it's not a good image for a man to be walking that closely behind random women. He just got into town. So he was fully conscious of the fact that there are certain principles of behavior with non-mahram men and women. Especially with women. Sometimes today I see men who are too comfortable with women, especially women of other people's households. The laughing, the joking, it's just too comfortable, the staring, and it's just not right. I'm sorry. This story tells us that back then, even today, we have to be, as men, conscious of the fact that inside, built into the fitrat of the woman, is this respect, this humbleness. And we have to be conscious of that. We can't put her in positions where she's uncomfortable, stand too close to her, right? Say inappropriate jokes in front of her, right? Refer to her using her first name, for example, especially in front of her husband or her son or her brother or her father. Let's be very respectful when it comes to our sisters and our women. Salli ala Muhammad, salli ala Muhammad, salli ala Muhammad, salli ala Muhammad, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. So Nabi Musa now says, I'm gonna walk in the front, you leave me from behind. This was such an act that was so beautiful for those sisters, for those women. Later on, now we'll find out why. Now they arrive at the old man's house. Alright, Jaza'idi's book says that when Nabi Musa met the old man, how he knew, I don't know. This is all before his prophethood now. But he knew right away this was Prophet Shu'ayb. There's a sense of calmness in that house. The way the books describe Nabi Musa entering into Nabi Shu'ayb's house was a sense of calmness, itminan, sukoon, almost as if I don't need to put on a face anymore. I don't need to pretend to be someone I'm not. And they were both men of God. Prophet Shu'ayb says, I appreciate what you've done for my daughters. Where are you? What's your story? Where are you coming from? Who are you? You're not someone that's from here. And Nabi Musa tells Nabi Shu'ayb his entire story. His entire story. And Nabi Shu'ayb says that, look, you're safe here. This is your dwelling. There's a room here. You can be here for as long as you want. Later on now, there's some contract in terms of times of years and blah, blah, blah. But initially he says, look, you're comfortable here. No one's going to bother you here. You're fine here. He gets a bite to eat. He rests up a little bit. And then those daughters approach their father. And they give him a brilliant idea. And another point of reflection for us here. It was such a good point. What was that suggestion? They would say, look, Baba, you need some help with your work. This individual is young, he's strong, and he's pious. He's God conscious. He's God conscious. Now, it's understood that they could understand, that they know why he was strong. I mean, the man lifted those buckets of water all by himself. When it took 8-10 men by the well, he just came in like a champ and just grabbed that bucket with one and two hands. But how do they measure his taqwa and his piety? Based on what? It goes back to that one moment of respect that Nabi Musa gave those women. It's not munasib. It's not appropriate for a non-mahram man to be seen like this with you leading and me following. Shaitan is everywhere. That one moment now, because this is now, this you won't find in the Quran. This is actually a hadith by Imam Radha alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, in Bahar, where he says, the father actually asked the daughter, how can you measure his taqwa? On what basis are you saying that he's God conscious? Like he wanted to know what is it that she saw or they saw in him. And they relate the story that on the way here, he was the one that walked in the front and we were in the back. Okay? And it's just that observation, that level. Look, when you are that high in spirituality, when you're that God conscious, you see God consciousness everywhere else. Your lens becomes that of God consciousness. So you pick up even the smallest acts of God consciousness. So you know what? There's piety inside. You know, sometimes, I tell you, sometimes my parents, I want you to pick up these things with your kids, with your teenage boys, teenage girls. You know, a lot of the youth out there, they have moments and they have jewels and gems inside them. And sometimes they show you those moments of God consciousness to the point where you feel like, you know what? Not all is lost. There's a brilliant side to my child. Accept that. Celebrate it. Right? These sisters now are telling their father that this one moment was enough for us to know this man is a God-conscious individual. So what better now, Baba? He has the physical strength, he has the spiritual strength as well. And then, you know, the next morning, conversation now begins. And Nabi Shu'ayb now speaks to Nabi Musa and offers him a deal or offers him some employment. Okay. Remember the dua of Nabi Musa now. Remember the dua of Musa entering this city not knowing what's going on. Okay? Not knowing what's going on. Just asking Allah, please let this be the right path. Whatever you send for me, I'll be more than happy. Okay, and this was that dua that he said after giving the buckets of water to those sisters. He doesn't say, Allah, I want this, I want that. No, he goes, whatever you send for me, I'll be more than happy. I'll be more than happy. Now all of a sudden his door's open. Can you imagine? He meets Prophet Shu'aib in his journey. 8 days of suffering. Ends up in a random town. He has no idea where he is. And lo and behold, right in front of him is a prophet of God. Are you kidding me? Seriously? I mean, is how did God carve that path? We have no idea. That's why sometimes we have to just submit to his plan. There's a plan he has for you. It's a plan he has for me. And sometimes we fight the plan, we ruin the plan, we change the plan. And it's like God saying, look, I had a plan for you, just let me execute my plan. Okay, it took that man in Fir'aun's palace, some random man that later on became someone who's famously known as a Mu'min Ali Fir'aun, to go and find Musa before Fir'aun's boys did. He said, look, get out of town, go. 8 days he travels, somehow survives. Ends up in this city at the door of the Prophet of God. And now Prophet Shu'aib the next day sits down with Nabi Musa, says, I want you to work for me. I want you to work for me. Not only is now he has accommodation, he's got a room, he now has a source of income. And then he offers him one more thing. Okay? And that one more thing, I'll leave for tomorrow, inshallah. Let's leave the story there. Let's come to the Quran in the verses. Let's open up your Qurans, please. Surah Qasas, Surah number 28. Now we're going to look at 7 different verses when it comes to this story I just told you. So verses 20 all the way down to 26. In the same Surah, Surah Qasas, the 28th chapter of the Quran, verses 20 all the way down to 26. Please, let's have your Quran opens. As a wife, as a husband, as a family, all of you hopefully are gathered around, right? And let's open up the Quran. Let's find out what it says about what I just mentioned to you, inshallah. Verse number 20 talks about that moment where Ezekiel comes to him and says, you better go, right? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Now, this is now where this man comes and finds Musa and says, look, they know that you killed that Egyptian. You better leave town. Verse number 20 of the 28th chapter. 28:20. Surah Qasas, verse number 20. How many more times should I say it? وَجَاءَ رَجُلٌ مِّنْ أَقْصَى الْمَدِينَةِ. Okay? A man came running from the remotest part of the city, meaning from the palace. He said, Musa, look, قَالَ يَا مُوسَى. These guys, these chiefs, Fir'aun's men, have consulted, and now you better leave at once. Because they have every plan. لَيْوَنْ لِيَقْتُلُوكَ. They're going to kill you. So what do? Go from here. Trust me, you'll find me one of the ones who wish well for you. I'm not somebody who you can't trust. You can trust me. Like, you know me. I'm going to do dua for you. You have to be protected. You're that one person, that one revolution that I was waiting for. So go, preserve yourself, protect yourself, safeguard yourself, and go from here. Leave town. Verse number 21. So Musa left. Verse number, the next verse now down. فَخَرَجَ مِنْهَا. He left. He left in a state of خَائِفًا يَتَرَقَّبْ. He was scared and he was waiting. He thought, okay, like the way that the tafsir says and the way that some of the other books say about this story is that he figured that Fir'aun's men would catch up to him, find him and kill him. So he was just waiting for that. Can you imagine the level of anxiety and stress this man has? Okay, even the prophets of God feel stress and anxiety. My individuals out there who are dealing with mental health issues out there, I ask you, please, don't ever assume that anxiety and fear and stress is a sign of you having low iman and low faith, or not relying on God, or not being grateful to God. No, this is a prophet of God, an ulul azam prophet of God, that he chooses to speak to later on in the story. This is a man who says, خَائِفًا يَتَرَقَّبْ. He was scared. He ran for his life. Then he prays to Allah, constantly praying to Allah. قَالَ رَبِّ نَجِّنِي مِنَ قَوْمِ الظَّالِمِ. Just free me from this. I don't want any part of Fir'aun's people or his palace or the unjust ways. I just want to be freed from that. So he leaves. Okay? And then he ends up in, Madian or Midian, as it's called sometimes. Midian sometimes in the Old Testament. Okay? I have a few minutes left. In fact, I'm over my time now. But we'll go over these verses right now, very quickly. So he turns to his face towards Madian, and he says what? Now the next verse, verse number 22, he says, قَالَ عَسَى رَبِّ أَنْ يَحْذِيَنِي سَوَاءَ السَّبِيلِ. That maybe, he says, maybe my Lord will guide me in the right path. That's that moment now. He's filled up the buckets now. The women are on their way back to their father's house. He turns to Allah, says, maybe this is where I should be. Hopefully now, this is where the right path should be. Okay? Now come to the next verse now. Verse number 23 now. Okay? This is where now he finds these two women. Okay? And I'll go over the English. Okay? And when he came to the water of Madian, he found on it a group of men watering, and found besides them two women. There were two women what? Keeping back their flocks. They were obviously away from everybody else. And so he approached them. قَالَ مَا خَتْبُكُمَا. What are you, like, everything okay? Yeah, what's the khabar here? What's happening? Is everything okay? You're a little bit away. Right? And that's when they say that we cannot water until the shepherds take away their sheep. Until these men leave, then we'll get in there, right? And then right away, like I said before, وَأَبُونَا شَيْخٌ كَبِيرٌ. The end of verse number 23. And oh, by the way, in case you're wondering why we women are sitting here, our father is very, very old. Okay? Another testament to the sheer piety of these two women, that before you could ask, where are the men of your house? We have to now explain that we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the fact that there was no male inside of our house. The one male is our father. He's too old now to do this. So what happens now? Now Musa now waters and gets water for the sheep, right? فَسَقَى لَهُمَا. Okay? Then went back to the shade. So he sent them on the way back, went back to the shade, and continued now to what? To beg to Allah, to pray to Allah. Look at the way that he asked Allah. He says, Rabbi, inni lima anzalta ilayya min khayrin faqir. Whatever you send for me, I'm in need of it, I'll accept it. Does not say, I want this, I want that, I'm a prophet of God, 8 days of a very difficult journey, give me this, give me that. No, very humble way of praying to God. Whatever you send to me, I will accept. And look where he ends up. Look where he ends up. Okay? And then, after this dua, one of them, this version says, one of them, ahadahuma, comes back to Nabi Musa. With news that what? My father wants to see you. My father wants to give you some, appreciate what you've done for us. Then one of the two women came to him walking bashfully. Again, I talked about the idea. Faja'atuhum ahadahuma tamshi. Tamshi in Arabic means a very humble way of walking and talking. Okay? And again, another point of akhlaq for our sisters. When you speak to men, when you speak to boys, when you speak to people who are non-madam, and you have to speak to them, be a little bit humble. Be soft in your tone. Don't be so free and so aggressive. Right? It's not becoming of a woman to be that forward and that comfortable with a non-madam man. There should be a level of uncomfortableness between you and the non-madam man. Okay? She says, my father invites you that he may give you the reward of your having watered for us. So when he came to him and gave to him the account, he said, fear not, you are secure from the unjust people. Meaning what? Now, when Musa now goes back to Nabi Shu'aib and tells him of the entire story, he says what? He goes, don't worry about it. La takhaf. Don't worry. Right? Najawta min al-qawmi al-dhalimin. You are now secure from those people. This is your home now. You can relax now. Those people are far, far away. They won't affect you. The story of Musa walking ahead of it is not in the Quran. Not at least here in these verses. It is in Bahar. It's very well known in Tafsir as well. The last verse I want to leave with you in the Iltimas Dua is that suggestion by the daughters to their father to employ him, as he's not only strong, he's also one of the more pious ones. So then now they say, قَالَتْ إِحْدَاهُمَا يَا أَبَتِي. Verse number 26, Surah Qasas. One of them says, one of the women says, girl says to his father, Ya father, employ him. Hire him. You need help. Hire him. He's qawi, he's strong. He's also ameen, he's trustworthy. He's faithful. He's a good man. How do we know that? Based on that akhlaq that he showed on the way towards the old man's house. Okay? So now Musa is in Prophet Shu'aib's house. Okay, offered this corner to work for him. There's another offer that Nabi Shu'aib makes to Nabi Musa, but I'm going to leave that for tomorrow, inshallah. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to accept our qalil efforts to understand your book, understand your words, so we can apply them, we can be better people because of them, and inshallah, we can be ready for the imam when they come, inshallah. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahu Akbar, la ilaha illallah. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان العين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salaam alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. And welcome to the program of Islamic upbringing here on IRIB English Radio. In this program, we discuss the problems and questions the parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawdha Ilmi Aqum. So, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Miqdad.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much.
So, Brother Miqdad, there's one of our listeners who has a question. Let me read the question for you. It says that when as moms get together, we talk about our children, and many times we laugh about the funny things they do and make mistakes that normal children make. Yesterday, my daughter heard me, and she's really upset with me. because I narrated something that happened at home. I'm not sure how to react. What would you suggest? So, Brother Magda, this is another problem that some of the parents get to face. What do you suggest?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, a couple of things regarding this. First and foremost, we talked about primary emotional needs of a child. And we said that one of the needs that a child has, and in fact, adults likewise, a sense of security, a sense of safety. And one of the things that this safety is related to is one's self-image or one's self-respect. So all of us as human beings have an idea of ourselves, an image of ourselves, which we like it to be positive in the eyes of others. This self-image, or what we call reputation, for example, right? The people know us as positive. People respect us because they count us as important or valuable and have give us honor, basically.
Right.
And this is fundamental in everyone of us. We don't like actually our esteem to be under question, right? And in fact, Islam has put a lot of emphasis on this as well. It's actually haram to humiliate somebody. It's actually a very wrong thing to remove someone's, as they say in Arabic, izzah, someone's esteem, someone's value, basically. To embarrass somebody, to make someone dhalil is extremely wrong in Islam. One of the things that comes back to this is this need that we have within ourselves, that in society we should be respected, we should be valued, and we have an image that we want to maintain, basically. And children have this as well. It's not that children don't understand. Perhaps they might not express themselves in this way, but we all have it within us, basically. We don't like others to mock us. We don't like other people to laugh at us. Children from the age of 3, 4, when they laughed at, they feel bad. They feel really sad and upset that this person is saying bad things about me. This girl, this boy is making fun of me. And they feel within themselves, basically.
Yeah.
One of the needs that people have, before I said this, and this is why in Islam, for example, you have so much emphasis on not doing ghibah, not backbiting, not revealing people's faults, giving respect to people, not embarrassing people, not talking of people in a way that makes them feel humiliated, etc. So Islam has a lot of emphasis on this. When it comes to children, it is the parents who are fulfilling this need of children. They need to ensure that the children always feel safe when it comes to their self-image and their self-respect.
Right.
And so parents should always act in a way to protect the child from any situation that will lead them to be embarrassed or laughed at.
So thank you so much, Brother Maghdad, and dear listeners, stay with us and we'll be right back after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
So welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. And we are talking about the self-respect. You know, everyone loves to have self-respect, even at the small age. You know, even children have got their self-respect. So we're talking to Brother Maghdad. Brother Maghdad, can you please continue?
Unfortunately, one of the things that happens is that when parents get together, when parents talk to one another, they count it normal or acceptable to talk about their children, and at times in a negative way. That's number one. And number two, perhaps not in a negative way, but in a way that might damage their self-image. That as parents, we count it very normal, very funny at times.
Yeah, and not necessarily with a bad intention.
But it could be counted as negative by the child itself, just like we have in this question. So regarding the first one, when we talk about our children in a negative way, this is actually quite damaging for tarbiyat. It goes against Islamic upbringing, that you talk to others about your child in a way that is positive, in a way that's very respectful.
Yeah.
Islam teaches us to always honor our children. It's interesting that once, for example, let me give you a story, the Holy Prophet was carrying Imam al-Hassan, Imam Hussein on his back, pretending to be a horse. And somebody comes by and says, oh, subhanAllah, how lucky these children are that they have such an amazing horse, right? And the Prophet turns around and says, no, rather say how lucky is this horse that he has such an amazing riders on it. In other words, the Prophet is bringing attention to the fact that when I introduce my children, I introduce them in a very beautiful way, in a very honorable and respectful way. So it's very important for parents to always keep in mind that when we talk about our children to others, we talk about them not as a burden upon in our lives. Not sometimes you say like, I haven't slept all night, my child keeps waking up, it's been affecting my work. And as if you're blaming the child and you're counting the child as a burden to your life. This is very negative. This can have negative, and not only just if the child hears it, even if the child doesn't hear it, it's actually a very negative perception that we're giving to others about our children and our family life. On the contrary, you see parents that are doing such a good work at upbringing, their parents were only saying positive about their children, that my child is amazing, my child this and my child that. And they feel very grateful and appreciate the fact that they have children, and Allah blesses this gratefulness that they have for having children. So the first point was that to always make sure that we speak very positive about our children and that we always introduce them in a very honorable and respectful way.
So basically we need to be careful that we maintain the respect and image even of our children. Thank you so much, dear listeners. Stay with us and we'll be right back after a short break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Islamic Upbringing. And we're talking about how we need to maintain the image and respect of our children. So, Brother Mighdad, let's continue.
The second point was that sometimes we don't talk negative about children. In fact, we just narrate things that, as parents, we find funny because children do very cute things, very innocent things that sometimes that we don't have any negative intention about this, but they're really funny events that happen, and we just narrate them to our friends. In a very light conversation basically about what's happening at home. Regarding this, we have to be careful because children, we perhaps might find them very innocent or very funny, but children perhaps might find that this is their self-image that isn't under question.
So children are basically, they're sensitive.
Exactly, they can be sensitive about it. Yeah. That
We might not have any bad intention, but they might take it wrong.
They might take it wrong, yes. They might feel that my parents have just disclosed something about us that was supposed to be at home, right? That was supposed to be a secret between us, what happened at home. I didn't want my this mistake, for example, to be heard by others, by my aunt or my mom's friends, for example. So we had to really try and make sure that even in this case, we're quite careful about what we say. When it comes to security, it's very, very important that as parents we grant the safety and security to our children, that things that they do, things that happens at home, always remains at home. The privacy of the home or the secrets of home should never go out. You know, sometimes you expect a child not to reveal secrets that mom and dad speak about at home, right? Similarly, if you want to teach them how to keep secrets that are at home and not let them out,
that's actually an amazing example.
Yeah, and we have to be the same as well as parents, that things that happen at home, although they were funny, they were embarrassing moments for our children, we keep them at home. When children feel really safe about that, they know that my secrets will not be revealed, or the embarrassing moment will not be revealed at home. What's happening is that they have this emotional need satisfied, they have this emotional need quenched. And this creates stability, this allows growth to happen.
Yeah.
If we don't grant this to our children, this safety feeling that, this stable feeling that secrets or embarrassing moments or funny moments that happen at home they won't be let out, then it creates a fear, it creates an anxiety, right? Oh. They feel really on edge about different things.
Okay.
You know, a child, for example, they make a mistake at home, everybody laughs at home. They get up and it's all forgotten. And they don't mind mom and dad laughing or sibling laughing because they know this is going to stay at home. It's a homely feeling, basically. But children that they don't feel safe, maybe if I do something, then mom will tell her friends and my image will be destroyed. They feel very insecure, and that at home they have to be constantly on edge. They have to be very anxious about it. They're constantly in fear.
Yeah.
And this is actually something that will go against their growth, that will really prevent a good, strong social, intellectual, spiritual growth. So, crucial foundation of Islamic upbringing is to always make sure that we respect and we give this safety to our children, that their self-image and their self-respect won't be ruined or won't be disclosed to outside of home. So, coming back to the question now, I think I answered about how this is perhaps a wrong thing that happened that needs to be corrected. So, I would suggest to this mother to speak to the daughter. Now, I don't know what age this daughter is because it wasn't mentioned in the question, but speak to the child and apologize. Say, okay, perhaps this was a mistake, without making it too much of a big deal out of it. But apologize and make it clear for them, basically. This is the important part. To make clear,
sort the things out.
Yeah, that this will not happen again, basically. That from now on, I've learned my lesson that things that happen at home will stay at home. And once the child knows this, then it'll become much more easier for them. They'll become much more, have much more stronger feeling of safety. They can feel safe, basically, that this will not happen. So the key is basically to make sure that from now on they know that this is not going to be repeated again.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Brother Maghdad. So even we need to maintain the privacy of our children. And dear listeners, thank you so much for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. And visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until another program, God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life. A way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome, my name is Amina Taylor, and we're coming to you from London. Now, tense news as a senior EU diplomat says the European Union's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, is rather downbeat about the prospects of sealing a new trade deal with Britain. This after a weekend of tense negotiations. Barnier briefed the bloc's national ambassadors in Brussels on Monday. He told envoys the EU and London were still not on the same page and that the ball is now firmly in the court of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Brexit sticking points have been whittled down to access to UK fishing waters and the so-called level playing field, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
For Brexit supporters and many coastal communities, this deal symbolises regaining sovereignty in an age-old dispute over fishing rights. The UK says British fishing grounds are first and foremost for British boats, but the EU wants things to stay relatively the same with access for its boats and no tariffs or taxes on goods crossing borders. The EU's bargaining chip is special access to the EU single market, which the UK wants to hold on to as 60% of the fish its boats catch is sold to the bloc. The EU says something's got to give, though. insisting Britain cannot have priority access to its own fisheries and the EU market.
Mais comment expliquer aux pêcheurs?
How do we explain to fishermen that they can't go into British waters, but then they import fish to Boulogne? That's very complicated, believe me.
Wars have almost been waged over these fishing waters. Britain and Iceland clashed over cod between the 1950s and 1970s, with the Royal Navy deploying 37 warships to protect British interests. The Scallop Wars in 2018 that saw French and British trawlmen come to blows in the English Channel threatened an uneasy truce reached in 2012, when the UK agreed to keep larger boats away from French waters in exchange for additional access rights. Since Britain formally left the EU on January 31st, negotiators have missed a series of deadlines to reach a deal with the world's largest trading bloc before the transition period ends on December 31st. And although the UK hopes these really are the last few days before a deal, it is not ruling out an extension.
I think we probably are now in the final few days in terms of being able to decide whether there can be an agreement. Of course, look, if the ambience warms up again and actually great progress is made and it's just about sorting out the detail, well, then you can always find more time, you can always extend. But I think unless we can resolve these quite fundamental divergences at the moment, then we are going to have to take a position in the next few days.
If a satisfactory deal is not reached, the British economy, which has already been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic, will suffer even more. And it will also mean bilateral trade falling back on World Trade Organization rules for 2021, which is far from Brexit's purported goal of taking back control. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And as these negotiations go down to the wire behind closed doors, both Brussels and London must be mindful of public opinion on this ultimate game of brinkmanship. Well, as are we. So we took to the streets of the capital and got some reactions.
It's a pretty difficult position, to be honest. The negotiations have been going on for 4 and a bit years, so you'd hope that they got to a resolution. But at the end of the day, you want a good deal rather than a deal that would compromise our rights. And personally, I think the main area is services. We haven't done a good job enough for the city. We're focusing on fishing, which is a massive part of our GDP. We should be looking at other priorities. So not too happy that that's turned into a political statement rather than an actual business one.
Economically, for sure, it would be worse off to leave the EU in the short term, but it might be better in like the medium to long term. But that depends on what kind of deal they struck, or if there is no deal, then I think nobody knows what will happen.
Well, I think there's a lot of brinkmanship going on, and I guess something will magically resolve itself before the end of the year. What kind of deal that is, I don't know, but I think the French are being over demanding on the fish, so they might have to give way on that. The Germans want to sell us cars and wouldn't want tariffs, and yeah, we want to sell and trade in Europe, so there's probably a bit of give and take on both sides, I guess.
But I believe in God, and that whatever will be, it will work out okay, and we'll all be all right in the long run. So I'm relaxed about it, basically.
I think that they kind of need to extension, but every time they always leave it till the last minute to rush these deals, and then they say they haven't got enough time. So I'd say they have an extension, but then are they just going to repeat the same thing again? Are we just going to have another few days left and then have to have another extension as well? So
I mean, it can't go on for much longer, because the European people, they're just getting more irritated and more irritated. I mean, now Macron is getting very vicious altogether, and I'm not English, but you know, when you look back on what the English did for the French during two world wars, they saved them from annihilation, and yet the French can turn around and be very vicious when they feel like it. So get out now is my advice.
Yes, it sounds to me as though there's a certain amount of lack of goodwill on both sides, I suspect. I don't feel that everybody's making a huge effort necessarily, at least not from what's reported. I'd be slightly surprised if there were an extension. It feels like the British government would quite like to get out of there with no solution. That's what it feels like to me, anyway.
Some other news now, as more unrest in France as protests against police violence and a new draft security bill quickly disintegrated into clashes as police used tear gas and trenches in an attempt to disperse the crowds. The march began peacefully enough, with thousands of people waving banners and chanting slogans against the government and the police. However, violence soon erupted.
To see all the police present surrounding us is crazy. It's as if we're criminals. The government treats the protesters as criminals.
This means a lot to me. I was a victim of police violence in April last year. I took a hit from a truncheon by a riot policeman, which broke my neck. Since then, I've been scared of the police. I no longer trust them, and I will never trust them.
Weeks of protests have forced President Emmanuel Macron to take another look at his draft security law, which criminalizes the video recording of police. Macron also acknowledged that ethnic minorities were more likely to be stopped by police after footage emerged of officers assaulting a black music producer. Police unions have responded angrily to the president's comments. While Chris Denhond is in program, Macron has said he will take another look at this controversial security bill. But will this be enough?
Yesterday, and because the current existing laws are more than sufficient to punish criminal behavior. So there is also a second problem for Macron. People inside his government, high government circles, they want to rewrite the law because they are not happy with the way that the French government is dealing with the security issue. And then there is a third element, inside the Senate, with a right-wing majority, they also want to rewrite this law. So it will take a while before this law will be applied and will be put into practice. And in the meantime, it's very probable that the protests will go on.
Now, Macron is dealing with not just this situation, but accusations of Islamophobia. Tough times for the French president here, Chris.
Yes, well, he positioned himself, since he is president, in the center of the political spectrum. But, in fact, his political practice, he is looking to his right and even to his far right. So he is copying parts of the far right party of Marine Le Pen concerning Muslims, concerning migrants, and concerning the way the security issue is dealt with. His problem is, the more he looks to his right, the more there is discontent on his left. So it's a dangerous situation for him, because when there were terrorist attacks, the public opinion, also under influence of the mass media, is going to the right and to the far right. But if he goes too much to the right, there is a real discount on the left, and people go, they take the streets, and when the lockdown is less severe and when demonstrations are authorized, which happens last weeks, people are on a massive way participating in demonstrations.
Now, on a final note, and very quickly for me here, Chris, he's got elections in April of 2022. This must worry him right now, the fact that he doesn't quite seem to be getting the balance right.
Well, he is really preparing his these elections. It's in less than a year, and the same thing. He is looking. The main danger for him is coming from the far right, Marine Le Pen, National Front Party, and on the left side, the progressive side, there are different candidates like Mélenchon. The Communist Party has a candidate. There will be other candidates. It's more divided. His main danger to be re-elected comes from the far right. That's why he's looking to the right at the moment.
All right, problems ahead there for the French president. Chris Denholm, thank you.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Robert, in Lakesh, 9,000 new Jewish homes in a Jerusalem area here in Al-Quds. I mean, this pays total lie and a sham to any ideas of peace, surely.
Absolutely. The Zionist entity has just approved 9,000 settler units, and specifically a settlement which is located in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. It's called Atarot. Now, Atarot settlement will essentially isolate, once it's expanded with these 9,000 settler units, isolate Ramallah to the north of East Jerusalem from East Jerusalem itself. And it's part of this larger effort by the Zionist entity to attempt to cut off Jerusalem al-Quds from the Palestinian people and prevent it from being a Palestinian capital in the future. We know that under a two-state solution, the Palestinian capital is supposed to be based in Jerusalem al-Quds and East Jerusalem al-Quds. And the other settlements, of course, in that area, like Givat HaMatos and also Ramat Shlomo, are also being expanded. So it's part of an effort by Israel to specifically attempt to isolate Palestinians from East Jerusalem al-Quds. On top of that, right now, they're undergoing a large-scale ethnic cleansing program inside of East Jerusalem al-Quds, with a massive expulsion campaign going on, and whilst they're demolishing Palestinian homes, around 400 Palestinians have been made homeless just in East Jerusalem al-Quds this year alone, which is a phenomenal figure. This is really should be alarming. However, the international community is it has failed time and time again to act. In fact, the statements coming out from them aren't even strong enough on these sort of things, let alone any sort of action coming about. So it just shows the international community is not in favor of actually delivering peace.
Indeed, and we have to remember, of course, that Netanyahu has elections, so this might be another pivot towards that.
Absolutely. This is something that Netanyahu, he will use to pander to his far-right base, and it's sort of projected that Netanyahu will go after trying to install a far-right religious government along with Naftali Bennett and his party, which, of course, if he's going to do that, he has to bring on the settler bloc. And this is, of course, 800,000 people, so there's a lot of people he's pandering to there.
Well, you know, it doesn't matter if Palestinian lives are at stake, if you can get your grubby hands on a few more votes. On to the social media reaction here, Robert.
The first one we've got here says, a two-state solution has been impossible for some time. Palestinians now need simple rule over their state. We have another one here as well commenting on this who says, we can all thank the UAE for recognizing the fascist apartheid occupation to stop this happening. Oh, wait, never mind.
And we move from an occupation entity to, well, what's going on in Michigan there?
Well, another settler colonial project, of course, is having its far-right moments. Donald Trump's crowd seem to be riding on the wave that has been created of this culture war, and actually threatening the Secretary of State over, of course, what's going on to do with the voting system in Michigan. And we've seen that this is not just in one state. We've seen that armed Trump supporters around the country, belonging to a lot of white supremacist groups as well, have been threatening a lot of state officials, and have even attempted to kidnap state officials for what they see as a threat on their rights and liberties. And of course, Trump is fueling this all the way. He's still not accepting his defeat to Joe Biden. His supporters absolutely do not accept his defeat. Even though he hasn't accepted the defeat, he is accepting that he's not going to be inaugurated again in January, as he is running a rally on that day, a pro-Trump rally he's going to be running on Inauguration Day. So it doesn't seem that he'll actually turn up there, as traditionally has been followed by presidents who lose their position or have completed their time in office. And Trump looks to be running, wanting to run in 2024. So it seems like this will go on for some time now.
Nothing's been traditional about this system, and perhaps just really shaken America's facade of democracy there. But your online reactions, the ones that you've scoped out, would be of interest to me.
The first we have here says, is this the well-regulated militia described in the 2A? Question mark. I think not. More like a dangerous group of right-wing nuts emboldened with deadly weapons. We have another one here as well who says, Trump's behavior and rhetoric has emboldened his swamp to be criminally aggressive. This is not news, but things have heated up in Michigan. Trump needs to be held accountable for the actions that he encourages.
All right, Robert and Lakesh, obviously you will continue to monitor the two stories you brought to our attention. Thank you. In some other news now, into Spain we go, because hundreds of far-right Vox supporters gathered in several major cities over the weekend to voice their contempt for the COVID-19 restrictions being imposed by the government. Speaking to local news outlets, protesters stated that, quote, Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez had taken away their freedoms and destroyed the economy. Also attending the protest, Vox party leader Santiago Abascal said that the constitution was at risk as the COVID-19 restrictions were eroding the rights of citizens. Counter-protests were blocked by police from congregating in the same area as Vox demonstrators to prevent clashes. 70 COVID-19 clinics have opened in the Russian capital just days after President Vladimir Putin ordered a large-scale immunization program. During a news conference, President Putin declared that the Russian-made Sputnik V vaccine will be made available to groups most at risk to the disaster, with the list including doctors, nurses, teachers, and social workers. Earlier last week, Russia's health minister, Mikhail Murashko, also announced that the country had already tested the vaccine on more than 100,000 of its citizens. So far, Russia has reported more than 2.4 million confirmed COVID-19 cases, the highest in Europe, with over 43,000 deaths. And of course, Ahmed Caballo back with us for social media. And this time we're talking Iranian tankers on their way, laden with oil, to Venezuela.
Yes, and this is apparently the largest fleet of oil tankers to date, and it defies the US ban. Now, this is again another example of Venezuela and Iran's cooperation. And both countries have many similarities, both are anti-imperialist countries, both are countries with huge, large oil reserves that the US wants to get its hands on. But what's interesting about these countries, in many ways, is in their own region, there are many client US client states that are hostile to them both. So in Iran, we have client states like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, that are trying to attack and undermine the Islamic Republic. And in Latin America, you have states like Colombia, Brazil, Chile, who are again working within the US interests and trying to undermine the Bolivarian revolution there. So what they've done is they look for alliances not only in their region, but they've looked further abroad and they've found some sort of cooperation, and they're willing to support each other because they're in the same boat. Elliot Abrams is the US special representative for Venezuela and Iran, and he wants to overthrow and implement regime change in both of their countries. Now, Anya from the Gray Zone is actually in Venezuela at the moment, and she says this: the US-led economic war against Venezuela has brought Caracas and Tehran closer together. Iran broke the blockade against Venezuela this year, delivering much needed crude and even opening a grocery store in the country. I found this mural in central Caracas. Not everyone agrees. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who's equally as hostile to Iran as he is to Venezuela, says this: Venezuela used to be a prosperous country. Under Maduro's corrupt and incompetent rule, the people of Venezuela are suffering. The US is helping the Venezuelan people in tangible ways, and we support a return to democracy through free and fair elections.
All right, now, let me just intervene for a second there, Ahmed, because this strikes me that the, perhaps I can be so bold as to call him the outgoing Secretary of State here, he makes this statement without a hint of irony. Is it not America that's backed the last destabilizing events to try and topple the legitimately elected government in Venezuela, Ahmed?
Yeah, in the last 18 months, they've sponsored three coup attempts that have failed miserably. Now, the suffering that he talks about in Venezuela are the result of U.S. sanctions. The Center for Economic Policy and Research at Washington, D.C., based think tank that says US sanctions have killed 40,000 people in Venezuela in 2017 alone, and the sanctions have intensified since then, so only God knows what the real figure is at this moment in time. So it's a bit rich to say that. And it leads us on to our next story, actually, because on December the 6th, there have been elections in Venezuela for the National Assembly. Now, the indications show that the PSUV coalition has won that with 80% of the votes counted, showing that they've got 67% of the vote. Yet the mainstream media, who seem to be acting in cahoots with the US State Department and the British Foreign Office, are very much trying to delegitimize the results. So this article from ABC says, Venez-